insurance, I was using it for fun. I still have it.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for coming to the class. Today's the last class. I hope over the class, first of all, those people who, for whom this is their second semester, I think that last time what we did was we kind of introduced American Orthodoxy in America. And this semester what we did was kind of really focus on very specific people and very specific kinds of questions that they were asked. Again, what I want to do is to kind of give a flavor of what Orthodoxy looked like in America. And at least in this class, we've gone beyond Orthodoxy. We looked at conservative tshuvos, we looked at reform tshuvos, and we looked at, for lack of a better term, different flavors of Orthodoxy. And the last flavor of Orthodoxy that I want to look at today is an extremely interesting person. His name was Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. A little background, and then we'll look at some of his material. Rabbi Henkin was born in 1881 in Belarus, what they basically call Lithuania. For our purposes, they call Lithuania. His father was the head of a yeshiva and his son's primary teacher. He married in 1903. He was 22 when he got married. He married the daughter of his Rosh Yeshiva. He was ordained. He received smicha. From 1905 to 1912, he was a rabbi in a small town in Lithuania. From 1913 to 1922, he was a teacher in a yeshiva, also in Lithuania. And in 1922, he moved to the United States. So his story is a very familiar story, which is the story of a rabbi who gets his rabbinic start in Lithuania. But due to pressures and due to difficulties in Eastern Europe, he moves here to the United States. Now, 1922, just to get the perspective, that's late compared to the people we've talked about. Rabbi Geffen came in 1903. Now, why is 1922 late? In 1924, the United States government first started limiting the quotas, the number of people who were allowed to come here to the United States from Europe. So 1920, and that really ended the influx of immigration the way we know it. So 1922 was really at the very end of this whole period, okay? So he comes here to the United States in 1922. He moves to the Lower East Side, and he becomes the rabbi of a shul that's called Anshei Shtutzen. A shul, a small, what we would call a shtiebel. His claim to fame, Rabbi Henkin, was, though, that in 1925, he becomes the director of an organization called Ezras Torah. Ezras Torah was an organization that was established in 1915 by the Orthodox rabbinate to assist Jews in Europe during World War I, during and after World War I. This organization continued through World War II, and it became one, if not the major Orthodox charity in the United States during those years. There still is an Ezras Torah. I'm not sure how successful it is, how much money they collect, but there still is an organization, and they're famous, and we'll talk more about this. They're famous because they put out the Luach. The little booklet that tells you the different customs in shul is put out by Ezras Torah. That was first thought of by Rabbi Henkin. That's why sometimes when people talk about Rabbi Henkin, they refer to Rabbi Henkin as the one who established Minig America. What does Minig America mean? Minig America means how we daven here in America. What weeks we say Avarachamim, when we say Tachnun, those kinds of things. You know, every community had slightly different customs. Rabbi Henkin established the custom in America. And to this day, most rabbis in their talis bag have that little Ezras Torah luach, which they consult to know these kinds of questions. I know when I grew up in Washington, D.C., in the Beis Medrash of the shul, on the door was the Ezras Torah luach. Right? That's my first introduction to all these things, was the Ezra's Torah Luach. And the rabbi used to check, when there was a question, whether or not to say Avarachamim, the rabbi checked the Ezra's Torah Luach. That was Rabbi Henkin's, really that was his first contribution to the American rabbinate. He died at the age of 92 in 1973. His son is Rabbi Lou Henkin, who's a professor, a distinguished professor at Columbia Law School. Professor Lou Henkin just celebrated his 90th birthday. I think that he still teaches at Columbia Law School. He's still an active member of Ramat Torah on 110th Street, and I know he celebrated his 90th birthday because I get their Shabbos announcements, and they made a kiddush for him out of his 90th birthday. Rabbi Henkin's grandson, who studied with his grandfather, is Rabbi Yehuda Henkin, who was a kind of a, what I would call, for lack of a better term, a modern Orthodox posek in Yerushalayim. You may have heard of him because his wife is Chana Henkin, who is the founder and director of Nishmat. Okay? So it all comes around. The Henkin family is connected to one another. She's, I'm sure, has spoken here in the Jewish Center, right?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Now, part of the problem, that's kind of just a, you know, a very quick introduction of who he was. And you know what? From that introduction, he was similar to the people we've looked at before and to many others who we know from this period. Part of the problem of evaluating Rabbi Henkin is that he was eclipsed by someone who lived literally down the block from him, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein was the great American posek before 1986. He was the great American posek. When people wanted a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi to decide questions for them, they went to Rav Moshe Feinstein. The joke was for many years that when a rabbi got smicha, on the back of his smicha was Rav Moshe Feinstein's phone number. And, you know, it was a joke, but it was a different time then. Today, you sometimes look for rabbis who answer the way they say it is, who answer their email, who respond to their email. In those days, you could actually call with Moshe Feinstein. People, rabbis called Rav Moshe Feinstein, they wrote to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and they received answers. He was the one who gave answers. However, and this is a very important however, what we don't often remember is the fact that the first volume of Rav Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvos was only published in 1959. At that point, Rabbi Henkin was already 80 years old. He was already 80 years old, which means that he had lived a life already. He had been a rabbi since 1922 here in the United States. He's been a rabbi, for 35 years here in the United States, deciding questions, writing answers, and all those things before Moshe ever paskened his tshuvos. And therefore, the study of Rabbi Henkin, I wasn't careful enough on that word, published his tshuvos, but when I say published his tshuvos, that's important because most people didn't know about Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvos until they were published, right? Okay, but that's you caught me and that's fair. Okay, now, why is Rabbi Henkin interesting? Rabbi Henkin was the posek of New York in the 1930s, the 1940s, and the 1950s. That is a very, very interesting time here in New York. What I want to do today is I want to look at three issues that were addressed by Rabbi Henkin. Issue number one is whether or not you can daven in a shul without a mechitza. Okay? Issue number two is about the Manhattan Eruv. And issue number three is whether or not a couple that was married by a Reform rabbi, do they need a get? Okay? Meaning, a couple is married by a Reform rabbi and the woman goes and remarries and has children. Are those children illegitimate children? Or did they not need a get because they were married by a Reform rabbi? These are all questions which are interesting to this day. But in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, when the Orthodox community here in the United States was really being formed, these were really very, very interesting questions. Okay, let's look at each of these questions. The first question has to do with davening in a shul without a mechitza. This needs a little bit of introduction. We talked about this a little bit last semester, but I want to look at it. We didn't look at Rabbi Henkin. He has a different view on this. If you remember, In the 1940s and the 1950s, the movement of the Jewish denomination that the Jews believed and America believed was going to be victorious, was going to be the leading denomination, was what?
Conservative.
Conservative. Everyone believed that Orthodoxy had no future and conservative was going to win. And what happened was the conservative movement was so strong that there, at least in the suburbs, there was a blending of the, an integration, a joining of the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement in some places. That they referred to, they kind of had a term for it. What did they call it? Conservadox. What did that mean? You had a shul that did not have a mechitza, that had a microphone, but for which the sitter was traditional, was Orthodox, the davening was completely Orthodox, and the people had grown up Orthodox, but for one reason or another, the mechitza was taken away, and the microphone was introduced. The microphone is an interesting topic, which we're not going to talk about. Mechitza became an issue in the 1950s. It became an issue in the 1950s because there were three cases in the 1950s which actually went to the secular courts, in which Balabatim opposed the introduction of mixed seating into the shuls, which means like this. There was separate seating, mechitza seating, but at some point the shul took a vote to introduce mixed seating. We talked about that last week with Rabbi Geffen. Remember, in 1958, Rabbi Geffen Shul, they brought in a new rabbi from JTS, and they voted to introduce mixed seating. This happened. But in three cases, there was someone who took the shul to court. The most famous was in the late 1950s in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Someone by the name of Baruch Litvin, who, there is a consensus about, was famous in Jewish history only because he took this case to court. Okay, this was his claim to fame. This became his, literally his mishigas. He collected letters from rabbis around the country claiming that a shul without a mechitza was not an Orthodox shul. Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Riskin has, Rabbi Lamb has in that book, collection, a big thick book, which he paid to publish by himself. Since then, it's become kind of a collector's item. Ktav republished it. But I remember a long time ago, Rabbi Riskin told me that when Rabbi Riskin was having his argument with, you know, in the early days of Lincoln Square, about whether or not there was going to be a mechitza in Lincoln Square, you know the story, took over a conservative shul, question whether there would be a mechitza or not, he said that he met with Baruch Litvin. And he says, and Baruch Litvin, he says, he encouraged him. Like, he was the guy, you know, that was already the 60s. He was the guy in the 50s and 60s who was encouraging young rabbis who were, had this struggle, you know, to make sure they had a mechitza in their shul. Yeah.
Do you know who was asked to be the rabbi of Lincoln's son?
No, who?
Rabbi Geffen's son.
The conservative rabbi.
Okay.
Oh, here you go. That's before Rabbi Riskin. Oh, that's good. So you see, it all comes together. It all comes together to the west side. Oh, very good. Thanks. Now, Baruch Litvin won. Now, he won in secular courts mainly because the board of directors of the shul made a tactical error. They thought that this was a silly thing to bring to the courts. So therefore, they didn't take the case seriously. Baruch Litvin spent 5 years, day and night, you know, collecting evidence and things. So he won more or less because he was the one who presented the case, and he was able to convince them whatever it was. But
it wasn't that simple. He had backing. He had members of the Orthodox Union attorneys who were working on this case, and they gave him a lot of legal talent for the case.
He based his argument on an obscure legal American statute that said that a majority of the church membership does not have the right to change an established practice within the church if even a minority opposes. Basically, that was the statute that said that a minority has the right to object, and therefore to prevent these changes from taking place. Supposedly, this statute had not been used or quoted or anything for 100 years. Somehow, this was located, and he won based on this. Okay, so maybe that was from the OU legal staff. I don't know that. I don't know that history, but that's interesting. Okay. Now,
very interesting, because many shul constitutions, Orthodox constitutions, starting in the 19th century, have a provision that you cannot change the format of the shul if even one person objects.
Okay, I mean, that's...
Look in your archives, you'll find these provisions in many shul, Orthodox shul constitutions.
Good, okay, that's interesting. Now, look at the first page. Here is page 125 from Litvin's book. And it's really good, because here, dear Mr. Litvin, can you imagine? Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's translated, but Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a letter to dear Mr. Litvin. In reference to what is written in my name, that the prohibition of mixed pews is biblical law, it would be better to change the words to read, the prohibition against praying in a synagogue without a mechitza of at least 18 tefachim. 18 tefachim is how much?
65 inches.
Yeah, about between, right, or 65 inches is a biblical law, right? There's some question about how big 18 tefachim is. 60 to 65 inches is a biblical law. Stronger emphasis should be put on the point that it is prohibited to pray in a synagogue without a proper mechitza, even though there is separate seating. Rav Moshe Feinstein says it very explicitly. What does Rav Moshe Feinstein say? That it's biblical law to have a mechitza. If you don't have a mechitza, and you daven in a shul without a mechitza, even if there's separate seating, you know, that kind of compromise of separate seating but no mechitza, you are in violation of biblical law. Right? Doesn't seem to be any question about that, does it? Written when? 1957. June 17th, 1957. What?
Where does he find biblical law?
That's a good question. That's a good question, because where does mechitza come from?
The Beis Hamikdash.
Right. The Beis Hamikdash, they had a mechitza. Okay, that's a good question. You should know that Rav Moshe Feinstein, his argument is kind of like this. Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument is that there was a mechitza in the Beis Hamikdash from the time of the Mishkan in the Torah. The Torah doesn't talk about it, but if the Beis Hamikdash had a mechitza, then the Mishkan had a mechitza too, and therefore it's biblical law to have a mechitza. His argument is not, I would not say ironclad. It's not tight, but that is his argument. Okay.
You went the reverse. You're saying that if the Beis Hamikdash had a mechitza, then the Mishkan.
We know the Beis Hamikdash had a mechitza. We know from the Mishnayos about Simchas Beis HaShoeva. That's where Moshe Feinstein assumed. That's what he assumes. Now,
why would women have gone into?
Well, because they were spectators. Why did, right, that's, you know, like in Simchas Beis HaShoeva, they went in because they were spectators. So the same reason they could be spectators in the Mishkan. Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument, I mean, you picked up on something. Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument is difficult. I mean, it needs to be analyzed where Rav Moshe Feinstein gets this from. For our purposes, I want to leave it at the fact that Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's a biblical law to have a mechitza. Turn the page. Rabbi Henkin. I want to read on page Yud Aleph. I want to read three short paragraphs. This is an article, a short article. Rabbi Henkin used to publish his articles in Hapardes. Hapardes was the rabbinic journal of that period. They were, Hapardes is not exactly, is not exactly available. So what they did was in 1981, they collected all of Rabbi Henkin's material and they put it together in two volumes called Kitvei HaRav Henkin. So this is a piece that once upon a time, in 1961, appeared in Hapardes.
Can I offer you a footnote?
Yes.
Hapardes took over Coca-Cola.
I do know that. Hapardes is important because we talked about last week. If you look at the night in the Hapardeses from 1930s, there were ads for Coca-Cola. What's interesting is I think there were ads for Coca-Cola before there was an official hashgacha from Rabbi Geffen, okay? Which is kind of interesting. Now,
we advertised
them first. Oh, you did? Okay, so here you go. Uwe Dorenu, going back how far? The 40s. So if you go, Hapardes began in around the year 1934. You can go there. They have in the rare book room in JTS. They have the Hapardeses from the 1930s, and you can go and you can look in the Hapardeses from the 1930s. There are ads for Coca-Cola. That's so interesting because Rabbi Geffen's Tshuva was only written in 1935. We don't even know how long it took before it became known. And Hapardes was already advertising Coca-Cola. Okay. Uvidorenu, he says, in our generation. Shiakitot reformer, Liminehem. Okay, the reformed Jews, there he says it. Parshim Reshet al Kol Yehudi Litsudo Bechermam. The reform movement is casting their net to grab all Jews, the reform movement. Yoter Yeshli Zaher Shalom Harchikam Vidanim Osam Ka'anusim. Says now, this is very interesting. He says now the reform movement is trying to, to capture all the Jews, more important than ever, not to reject them, but to include them within the Jewish people. Veins associer Dibre Aposkim Shemit Starpin Osam. Bevadai Mimakam Yudim Ksherim Im Yachiporik Ol Vesarme Aderech Ma'anishim Oso Vafil Macharimim Aldas Kahal. The Chaim Shahukra is the Mitzarpin Osal Dovish Bekdusha. Aval b'mekomo shirabu hachotim vein kochenu yafe v'anu tzrichim ko Yehudi abala beisak nesas lehispalel ein botkin acharov umitzarfin oto v'ar bechotin lemutov rak b'im hu mekalkel rabbi beisak neset umesit b'vaday sheish leharchiko. In 1961, Rabbi Henkin writes a piece that you would expect that MJE would write in 2007. You know what he says? He says that in a generation when there were many sinners, You have to embrace the sinner. You have to embrace the reform movement. And therefore, there is no question that a reform Jew can be counted for a minyan, and a reform Jew can get an aliyah. He says, because if you don't include them, then they're going to rebel against us. If you include them, there's a chance that they will return to the fold. That's interesting. 1961. It's a long time ago.
And a shaila of whether you could use a sefer Torah that came from
people. You know, all these shahs, I will tell you, the custom among most Orthodox Shuls is that we count all Jews for the minyan, right? And you give aliyahs to all Jews. I mean, you'd be hard pressed in our communities to find a shul that would, that would ask whether or not you took the subway to shul before they gave you an aliyah, right? That happens to come from Rav Henkin. This tshuva and Rav Henkin's general approach, long before there was an outreach movement, right? When did the outreach movement start? The outreach movement started probably with the beginner service in Lincoln Square Synagogue in the 1970s. That's 15 years after this tshuva is written. That's an eternity, right? That's an eternity that's so. Already Rabbi Henkin was writing that you have to include Reformed Jews within the community because that's the best way to bring them back to the community. It's amazing to read this, okay? Kol Yachid, look what he says in the next paragraph. Ra'uy lo livchor makom shel ksherim v'yirei Hashem im yeshlim tzokayla. You should choose to live in a community of religious Jews. Aval im ein makom kazeh ein lahachmir. Says, but you know what? If there's no such place, and it's hard to find the place, whatever it is, don't get crazy. Kiyasi de kula v'kil kula means because if you live in a community where you don't really want to live, bad things happen. That's kind of like family psychology, right? Be careful. Don't live in a bad place because you're going to have other problems. V'amnam. Im hamakom be'atzmo mikulkal. Sheyesh bo seder l'taruvot im nashim. If the place where you live is a place where there is a mixed shul, meaning a shul without a mechitza, kfar horu bazesh shenoach v'hagun yoter litpalel yichidei. It's already been decided it's better to daven at home than to daven in a conservative shul. V'mein makom klal v'yitztaref litpalel tamid yichidei. Yesh la'ayin bazeh ad heichan magia hakilkul. Says, but you know what? If you live in a community which only has a conservative shul, and your choice is that you're going to have to daven all the time in a conservative shul, all the time by yourself, because the alternative is a conservative shul, then you have to decide what you're going to do. Ul'umato atikva al atikun mehishtatfut haksherim. Al kol panim tzarich limchotu lohochiyach. He says, listen, if you live in a community, the only shul is a conservative shul, you know what? You have to judge. Maybe you're davening in the conservative shul, because you're not going to daven by yourself all the time. It's bad for your children, it's bad for you. You're not going to daven by yourself. But when you daven in a shul without a mechitza, you should let it be known that you think that's wrong. Now, this line does not exactly sound like Rav Moshe Feinstein. Does it? Rav Moshe Feinstein says, however, we know it, David, but Rav Moshe Feinstein says that it's a biblical prohibition against davening a shul without a mechitza. Rabbi Henkin seems to say that what? What does he say? It's not good to daven a shul without a mechitza, but if you live in a community and the only shul is a non-mechitza shul, then you know what? Probably better to daven in a non-mechitza shul than to daven at home all the time. That's an unbelievable thing for an Orthodox rabbi to say. Is it not?
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Can I ask you a question? Yeah. Was that the theory under which in the late 40s, early 50s, why you sent some of the Muslims to conservative shuls to be the rabbis?
What?
David Golovensky, Marshawitz, I mean, they sat on notable synagogues and even had fundraisers for YU at the time.
You know, the truth is, I mean, there's a double. You know, on one level, they sent them to conservative shuls. They thought they'd introduce mechitzas.
Right.
On the other level, there were no jobs. There weren't Orthodox shuls, right? These rabbis, you know, they went to these great conservative shuls, right? Like Golovensky went to Bethel and New Rochelle. These are great shuls, and they couldn't get jobs. There were no Orthodox shuls. So it was a combination of the two. Rabbi Henkin's tshuva is an amazing, amazing tshuva. It's not, I want to tell you something. It is not a well-known tshuva. You're not going to find it discussed in places. Today we live a life of luxury. We don't have this problem. Obviously, some people can have this problem, but you know, it's not a prevalent problem the way that it was. But in 1961, and he writes it in 1961, means it was a problem in the 1950s. This was a real problem. This is an amazing thing that he writes, that an Orthodox Jew can daven in a shul without a mechitza. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, Moshe's shul originally, as a result of Litvin, was as a result of a shul changing its status and wanting to introduce Nipsedim without a pizza. Rav Henkin is responding to people who lived outside in places where they had only one choice, not an at home or a conservative shul.
Good.
So you have to differentiate based upon who is asking the shaila and what the circumstances were, as opposed to a blanket sort of a statement.
Good. I'm going to get to that. I was going to get to that in the next sentence. Here we go.
It's also dealing with the sociological events of the 50s, where Jews moved out of Manhattan and Brooklyn, moved to the suburbs, moved to Long Island, to new communities, and left their old veterans, for example.
Levittown. The Levittown phenomenon. This we did talk about last year, right? The Levittown phenomenon. Very good. Of course. Now, I want to go back to the simplest point. This is a very important point. So, Rav Moshe Feinstein says you can't daven in the shul without a mechitza. Rabbi Henkin says you can daven in the shul without a mechitza. Here are two rabbanim, come from Eastern Europe. They come from the same neighborhood in Eastern Europe. Same neighborhood. Lithuanians in Eastern Europe, right? They literally come from the same block on the Lower East Side. Their background is the same. They're best friends. They study together. They learn together. They share Talmidim together. What is the difference between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Henkin? And here I just want to tweak what you said, but exactly, you know, that's exactly right. Rav Moshe Feinstein is a posek. What does it mean to be a posek? Fancy word, a posek. A rabbinic decisor. What does that mean? Rav Moshe Feinstein believed, and we know this from his tshuvos, he wasn't only writing answers to one individual. He believed that his role when he wrote these answers, they had broad impact. When Rav Moshe Feinstein gave advice to a doctor, who had just, you know, graduated medical school in 1971, about how to be a doctor on Shabbos. He wasn't only talking to that doctor who just graduated Einstein Medical School. He was talking to a generation, and now we're the second and the third generation of those people, of those doctors, who needed to know how to deal with Shabbos, right? How to deal with Jews and non-Jews and traveling and all those kinds of things. And he understood that, and if you read the tshuva, you appreciate that in the tshuva. Rav Henkin is a community rabbi. Rav Henkin is a rabbi of the shtiebel on the Lower East Side. He felt himself as a community rabbi. As a community rabbi, he was much less concerned with the broad impact of his tshuva. He was much more concerned with dealing with specific issues as they arose. Now, he doesn't address this essay to a specific person. But you know from the way that he writes that he's talking about suburban communities, right? He's talking about very, very specific kinds of communities. So it's very much a dip. You see, if you say to Rabbi Henkin, you know, but what does it mean? And what's the impact going to be in the broader community? And what's it going to mean in the future? And all those kinds of things. Rabbi Henkin, he had a different view of his tshuvos. He saw himself as a community rav rather than as the posek hador, as the one who was deciding for now and for all generations. Now, I got to fine tune that. I think we'll be able to see that even more clearly. But I think that distinction he made is a very important distinction. And I think that you see, the other thing is, you see, Rav Henkin didn't comment in the Litvin book. Now, part of the reason he didn't comment in the Litvin book because his view about Mechitza seemed to have been more liberal. But he wasn't interested in commenting in the Litvin book. He was not an American posek who wrote articles for the Litvin book. He was an old rav who lived in Lower East Side. Arthur, do you want to say something?
No.
Okay. I think that's an
important point. Was this
in
the
Asking the Child?
Yeah. 1961.
He said to me, he was blind. He said to me, this is to you. I'm talking to you.
Good. Okay, so that's proof to this, right? Means he was a different type of posek. We're not studying Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik also had this. This is a whole interesting topic. I kind of bring this up maybe one semester we can talk about this. The Lithuanians, they answered questions that were asked to them. Means you ask me whether you could do this in this situation, I'm going to tell you what the answer is. When somebody else comes to him the next week and asks him the same question, he had a completely different answer. Doesn't mean that he forgot what he learned the week before. Doesn't mean that he's smarter this week. Means that, you know, they weren't concerned about that. They answered what they thought was right for this person at this moment based on everything they knew. They weren't worried about the fact that someone would say the rub said cheese was kosher and the rub said cheese was not kosher, or whatever the rub said and all those kinds of things. They never wanted that to happen. The last thing in the world the rub would want to happen is that people would be sitting around, you know, in the year 2007, arguing about what his tshuvas were. It's exactly what your story is about Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin says, you ask me a question, I'm going to give you the answer. Don't tell me 20 years from now your grandchildren say, you know, that you say, Rav Henkin said this to my grandfather and therefore I'm going to do this. That wasn't what he was interested in, right? A different kind of rabbi. A community rabbi. The truth of the matter is, can I tell you something? That's the kind of rabbi we know. I think, right? Means the shul rabbi. When you go to the shul rabbi and you ask him a question, the shul rabbi is not publishing that answer. You ask him a question and he gives you an answer. That answer is for you. Now, in the age of communication, he may know that everything he says to any one of his members can be around the world in 5 minutes. That may be true, but he's answering that question for you. Rav Henkin was that kind of model. He was not the Rav Moshe Feinstein kind of model. Okay? Now, next question. Manhattan Eruv. Okay? 1949. First of all, back up a minute. 1905, the first Manhattan Eruv on the Lower East Side. Rabbi Yehoshua Siegel, the Sherpser Rav, built an Eruv. It was a triangle. The water in the bottom tip of Manhattan, the East River and the 3rd Avenue L, made a triangle. There was an area in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We know, Rav Henkin writes it up to the year 1940, the Hasidim on the Lower East Side were still carrying, relying on the Erev. The Litvaks were against the Erev. There was a book written by one of the founders of YU, Rabbi Yehuda David Bernstein, in 1910, in which he opposed the building of the Erev. Okay. Rabbi Siegel, the Sherpster Rav, was a controversial Rav. He was a Polisher on the Lower East Side, where most of the Jews were Lithuanian. He was insulted that in 1888 they brought in Rabbi Jacob Joseph to be the chief rabbi. He thought, since he had been in the community for a whole 8 or 10 years before that, that he was worthy to be the chief rabbi. And he actually had a group that opposed the chief rabbi, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. And the famous story is that he put, you know, that he announced himself to be the chief rabbi of the Polish Kehilos on the Lower East Side. When someone asked him, "Who made you the chief rabbi?" his answer was, "The sign maker." Okay, that's what he was like. That was his personality. Okay, by the 1940s, the Jewish community had largely moved out of the Lower East Side. Didn't mean there wasn't a strong community in the Lower East Side, but obviously the Jews had moved out, and there was a question about what to do about, you know, about carrying on Shabbos. Now, you understand, in 1949, we're not talking about every community having an Erev. No communities had Erev. St. Louis had an Erev, and Toronto had an Erev, and that was it. Right? So, we're not talking about the fact, like today. Today, you move to a new community, the first thing you need is an Erev. Why? Because no one is going to move to your community, because every community has an Erev. You'd be ridiculous to move to a community without an Erev. No community had an Erev. But they thought of Manhattan, there should be an Erev. Why they think in Manhattan there should be an Erev? Because basically Manhattan is an island, and an island, the seawalls in the island create the Erev, and therefore it should be easy to make an Erev in Manhattan. In 1949, the Amshin of a Rebbe was one of these Rebbe's. He lived in Brooklyn, but he kind of was, you would think he was kind of a West End Avenue Rebbe. What do I mean a West End Avenue Rebbe? He was a Rebbe who got along with the Hasidim, with the Misnagdim, with the people in three-piece suits and the people in Bekishes. He was one of these guys who, you know, who just got along with everybody. And he was one of these people who was very, very involved in the community. And he had respect within the rabbinic community. The Amshin of a Rebbe gathered together the rabbis, the rebbes, the Rosh Yeshivas of that period, and they decided to explore the possibility of building an Erev around Manhattan, meaning creating an Erev using the seawall, creating an Erev around Manhattan. The Erev was only finally established in 1962. Okay, there was a lot of dispute. Rav Moshe Feinstein came out against the Erev. In a number of tshuvos, Rav Moshe Feinstein came out against the Erev. Now, it seems as if Rav Moshe Feinstein, well, there are different reports about whether Rav Moshe Feinstein was always against the Erev, but at the end, Rav Moshe Feinstein was clearly against the Erev. Rabbi Lamb tells the following story. Rabbi Lamb says that in 1962, just when the Erev was finally announced by the rabbis, and you know, Rabbi Lamb, Rabbi Lookstein, you know, the modern Orthodox rabbis here in Manhattan, they announced the establishment of the Erev. The Erev, by the end, the person who's given credit for the Erev is Rabbi Kasher. Okay, Rabbi Kasher, who was a Gera Chassid, who davened in the Ridniker Shtiebel on 89th Street, and he really was the one who took the Erev under his wings. He didn't start it again. It was Yamshin Aver who started it, but he was the one who did a lot of work, Rabbi Kasher's Erev. 1962, Rabbi Lamb was invited to a meeting of the Agudas HaRabban. He was invited as the rabbi here. And the meeting was presided over by Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler was the dean of the Lithuanian rabbis in Rosh Yeshiva. He was an extremely strong personality. He was absolutely opposed to the Erev. He thought the Erev was going to lead to Chilul Shabbos and bad things. He was absolutely opposed to the Erev. He was an old man, Rav Aaron Cutler, at that time, old and sick. He ran the meeting, and he called on Rabbi Lamb to say a few words as the, you know, representative of the rabbinic community. By the way, that in itself is so interesting. You think today about a meeting of the Rosh Yeshiva, they'd never in a billion years invite the rabbi to come. But they invited Rabbi Lamb. Rabbi Lamb was respected, obviously, you know, in their circles, and he was invited to come. He had been a rabbi just here. He came in 1958. This was 1962. He was basically a newcomer here, but he was invited to the meeting. And he said an unbelievable thing. Rabbi Lamb tells the story. He said an unbelievable thing to Rav Aaron Cutler. He said to Rav Aaron Cutler, he says, "Listen," he says, "I don't need this Erev." He says, "For me, I don't need the Erev." He says, "But I want to tell you something." He says, after 120 years, he says, when you meet my Balabatim up in heaven, he says, you're going to have to explain to them why you were the cause of their Chilul Shabbos. That was what he said to Rav Aaron Cutler. And the way Rabbi Lamb tells the story is Rav Aaron Cutler backed down. I mean, backed out. I mean, he didn't respond. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler passed away that summer. So, you know, there's no follow-up to the story. Rabbi Lamb says, he says, hey, I have no idea what it is. But, you know, he backed down. Now, so what happened? And that's a very interesting story. That story is reflective of what the Manhattan Eruv was, which is there were two parallel views about the Manhattan Eruv all the years, right? Some held by the Manhattan Eruv, and some rejected the Manhattan Eruv. You know that there was a change in 1988 or something. Rabbi Schachter here, he repaired, he improved the Manhattan Eruv. Then in 1998, there was a new Eruv that was built first on the west side, and now it goes down to West 4th Street. So there's a more recent history of that, which is for some other time. But that's a fascinating, first of all, it's an unbelievable story about Rabbi Lamb. And, you know, generally, it's an interesting story about Manhattan. Rav Henkin. Where did Rav Henkin come out in terms of this question, okay? The Rashi Yeshiva were against the Eruv, right? The Litvisher Rashi Yeshiva, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Cutler were against the Eruv. Look on page Lamed Gimel here. Again, 1961. 1961 is an extremely important year because the Eruv is completed in 1962. So 1961 is right at the end. The Inyan Eruvin b'Manhattan. Okay, you see where I am between Eruvin b'Manhattan? Kvar Giliti Dati. I've already made my view clear. Shebifratim ani maskim rabbanan balei aheter. Ubifratim inini misupak. Uvikar imu kol apratzot gdurot. He says, I basically support those who say there is an Eruv. I want to make sure that the Eruv is constructed properly. There are no breaks in the Eruv. But as long as you prove to me there are no breaks in the Eruv, then I'm in support of the Eruv. He wrote a book about Eruvin. There's nothing bad if you want to carry in the Eruv, absolutely allowed to carry in the Eruv. Look what he says at the end. He calls for a rabbinic conference. He says, who am I to say the Eruv is okay? We need a rabbinic conference. He says, okay, then we need a rabbinic conference to decide finally about the Eruv. Okay, very good. Now, oh, by the way, I just want to tell you, one of Rabbi Feinstein's tshuvos is addressed to Rabbi Young about the Eruv, in which Rabbi Young asks him what he thinks, and he comes out against the Eruv. But again, it was addressed to Rabbi Young. Now, what does he say? He's a little hesitant to be the one who makes the decision, but here Rabbi Henkin says that what? So the Eruv is okay. The Eruv seems okay. Right? As long as the Eruv is constructed properly, the Eruv seems okay. Again, very different kind of answer. Yeah.
Moshe's issue with the Eruv was that it wasn't kosher because it was an Hashkafah issue. Rabban Butler was an Hashkafah issue. He wasn't addressing the kashrus of a particular Eruv in Manhattan. He was saying that if you create an Eruv, it will lead to all kinds of Chilul Shabbos was actually talking about that my Balabatim are therefore going to carry, and had you allowed the Eruv, they wouldn't have had this little Shabbos, and that's why you're going to answer to them in other Shabbos. So it's two different approaches, really.
There's no question. The 21st century today, those people who work on Eruvin, they argue that Rav Moshe Feinstein was swayed in his halacha by Rav Aaron Cutler's Hashkafa. If you're interested in this topic, I have something posted on it. If you go into the svarimblog.org or blogspot, go Google Svarimblog and put in Eruv, Manhattan Eruv. I have a long piece about this. If you read Rav Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvos, it seems that Rav Moshe Feinstein is deferential to Rav Aaron Cutler. There were Erevin in the big cities in Europe before the war. We know that. In Warsaw and Paris, there were Erevin before the war. The question of the fact that the Erev was not acceptable, it's not that it's a puzzle Erev, the problem was a big city, right? Rav Moshe Feinstein's problem was an Erev in a big city. Seems to be that the halakha can go either way. There is a very strong argument to say that Rav Moshe Feinstein was swayed by Rav Aaron Cutler. And Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote his tshuvos only after the Agudas Harabbanim meetings in which Rav Aaron Cutler stated his hashkafa point. Now, it's too hard to prove that, and I'm not sure even in the article that I proved that 100%, but your point is a right point. You just need to analyze where that is coming from. Rav Henkin's approach is without question. Rav Henkin seems to be, supporting or at least allowing people to hold by the Erev. Again, you have the same amazing thing. You have a Lithuanian rabbi who is in support of that which, the classic Lithuanian approach was opposed, which is, number one, Mechitza, no Mechitza, and number two, the Manhattan Erev. Number three. Yes.
Just as a little digression, you are standing in the spot that the week before Pesach, Rabbi Israel, you're sitting in the spot, that the week before Pesach, Rabbi Israel Silverstein would establish the Erev for the coming year by making the bracha, and there would be a 5-pound box of fresh matzahs, which were then stored just about here where the wall, back where the wall was. And if you came to Shacharis that week, you would catch the ceremony with Rabbi Young and Rabbi Silverstein, or Rabbi Land and Rabbi Silverstein. But it was Rabbi Silverstein who would do that ritual. Also, in the mid-70s, in lieu of a Shabbos HaGadol of Russia, Rabbi Land gave a discourse on the Manhattan Erev.
Every year?
No.
Yes. One particular year in the mid-70s.
That the Erev was intact.
Every year made that announcement.
Right.
Okay.
But he gave a discourse. Instead of the Shabbos HaGadol of Russia, he gave a shiur on the Manhattan Erev. And he explained why all of the objections were not correct, why the whole issue of Rishus HaRabim, the 600,000, didn't work in Manhattan, why the Mechitzas all around the island were appropriate and correct, and he went through all of the objections, and he explained why these objections were not correct, and why the Manhattan Erev was appropriate and was kosher.
And
that is interesting.
He brought it back to Warsaw.
Oh, he did. So that's okay. That's what I'm saying. I mean, that's a very important piece.
He
talks all about all of this. Okay.
He explained the whole history.
Did he tell the story about how he confronted Rav Aaron Cutler in the meeting?
I don't recollect it.
It's a good story. If he told it, you would remember it. Okay. Good. Okay. Very good. I mean, okay. I told you. I mean, Rabbi Lamb was the champion. Of the Manhattan Erev. There's no question that Rabbi Lamb was the champion. Here we go. So here you know it's history.
Announcing that the Erev is in effect.
And Rabbi Shachter was extremely important in terms of improving, Rabbi Kasher is amazing. Rabbi Kasher wrote his... Rabbi Kasher was a great Talmud Chacham. I don't know if I see it here in the library, but there's a multi-volume work called Torah Shlema, which he collects, Rabbi Kasher collected all of the Midrashim on Chumash. It's a great work. And he has 4 volumes of his Tshuvos. And, in one whole volume of his tshuvos is all of the communication and correspondence and all of his letters and things about Manhattan Erev. If you're interested in this, you can read this, and it's a fascinating thing.
I just want to ask you one question. In the beginning of this class, you were talking about Judaism in America. Do you think that this conflict had to do with Judaism in America?
There is no question that the Eastern European Rav in America was conflicted about whether or not they wanted to reestablish Eastern European Jewry in America, or whether they were willing to deal with an American Judaism. That, you know, now, you may think that that's an ancient history, but if you read, you know, any of the Haredi newspapers or blogs or anything today, you know, I mean, it's important. You don't have to read it. You don't have to read it because you want to follow it. You want to read it because you want to understand kind of the, you know, the nuance and the personality of the community. They want to reinvent an Eastern Europe here in the United States. There is no question that was a big issue about whether or not they were willing to accept an American Orthodoxy. It may sound like a very small thing to write a luach, the Ezra's Torah luach that Rabbi Henkin did, talk about Minig America, about when you say Abarachman, when you say Tachman. It was huge. Because they never would have imagined it. The Minig America was the Minig Kovna, right? I mean, what did you do here in America? You did what you did in Kovna. What your grandfather remembered from Kovna, that's what you did. After the Second World War, that became a little trickier because, you know, there was a break. All of a sudden, you know, there weren't people from Kovna anymore. You weren't quite sure what happened, and therefore there was a crisis, and therefore, you know, Ravenkin's Luach kind of took off, right? You know, but you've identified something. It's very, very hard, you know, to pinpoint it. But there is no question that there is a book that can be written dividing those rabbis who believe in what you'd call Minig America and those rabbis who believe or call, you know, who believe in Minig Lithuania here in the United States. Yeah.
This week is the continuing anniversary of one of the great manifestations of that idea. Because for many years, Rabbi Young said no Tachlin on Thanksgiving.
Correct.
Thanksgiving was the great non-denominational holiday throughout America, and we have to recognize, I mean, he gave these speeches, we have to recognize what America has done for us, and Thanksgiving is a time to do it, it's not a time for Tachlin.
That's fantastic. You should know that in KJ, there was a Thanksgiving service. I mean, it's not so long ago, right? There was that Rabbi Joseph Lookstein had a Thanksgiving service. That's an amazing thing, right? They, you know, so Rabbi Young, they didn't say Tachlin, you know, there was no Thanksgiving service. This is a whole phenomenon.
They asked the question of whether you could eat turkey.
Right, you know, and Rabbi Soloveitchik ate turkey, which was controversial, but, you know, they had Thanksgiving dinner in Boston. That generation that, you know, that America, you know, let's be honest, America saved that generation. And we're not talking about post-Holocaust. When we talk about Rabbi Young, we talk about, you know, Rabbi Joseph Lookstein, and we talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik, we're not talking about a generation that was saved from the Holocaust. We're talking about a generation that came in the early 1900s, you know, or the, you know, whatever, the first quarter of the 1900s, and the United States, you know, gave them an opportunity, and they were tremendously grateful. Here you go. So everything has contemporary relevance. But here we go. Bikidushin, let's just pull this whole thing together. Bikidushin should be temple should reformer.
What page is that?
The Ramosha Feinstein Tshuva. There are two pages of Ramosha Feinstein Tshuva. You have it front and back, but whatever. Okay. You got it? You have it? Yeah. Bikidushin should be temple should reformer. Here's the following question. The question is like this. A woman got married to a man in a reform shul, and they got divorced, but she didn't get a get. She got remarried. She had children. Are those children illegitimate children? Okay? That's an important question, isn't it?
Absolutely.
V'dvar ha'isha, sheni says the Talmud, b'seminar ha'reform, l'rabbis, b'temple shalahem b'London. Okay? She got married to a reform rabbi in a temple in London. U'lefi divra isha lo ha'yusham shomri Torah el'racha ve'rav me'a seminar. She said there were no Orthodox people there. There were only, you know, reform rabbis. V'zebaro she'a rabbis to reform named Kofrim b'yoter, who grew in mistam reformers, she'a mesitu madichum sulim kulim ledus. Reform rabbis even worse than regular reform Jews, because they cause others to sin. Okay? Absalom niskap l'aleim b'bezdim b'fneihem. Okay? By the way, Ramosha Feinstein is not very political. Right? He doesn't exactly, you know, he's not exactly politically correct. You know, he tells you, the reform rabbis are worse than regular reform because they're kofrim, ugruim, you know, they're just terrible because they're mesitim, umadichim, upsulim, kulam leidus, right? Because they cause other people to sin. Boom. Okay? Kimyacha shev mefursamim lekofrim, umesitim, umadichim, yiduim, umakirehem. Huragilui milsob almahu she'in tzarech ledin kabbalah seidus. Okay? He says that basically none of these reform rabbis are acceptable as witnesses. I am a Sifra Igris Moshe Chelek Eben Oezer Linyan Elish Ovdim be factories be Shabbos. Okay, he has a discussion whether someone who works in a factory on Shabbos is allowed to be a witness at a wedding. Vesimim pei reish to hear a Rambam Linyan Yiduim the Kofrim. Ah, Tzarich Lachkor. Now I read carefully. We have to analyze or evaluate. Maf she'efshar, what's possible? Ulai hayu sham shnei anashim ksheirim le'edus. Maybe there were two people, two kosher witnesses in the audience. Means the rabbi who officiated was a reform rabbi. Right, but there could have been two people. That's funny. Afshim istaber shor emesu ki divareha. Demayasu betemple shor reformer anashim ksheirim. To us, we come, Eslishab. He says, what are religious Jews going to be doing in a reform temple? You know they can't go into a reform temple. The Lachain. She got married 22 years earlier. Boom. She got married in a Reform temple. The rabbi was a Reform rabbi. The witnesses were Reform witnesses. Therefore, what?
No,
the children from the second marriage are not illegitimate children. The first marriage was not a real marriage, and therefore everything is okay. That's what Moshe Feinstein writes.
They did the same thing with conservative rabbis too.
Here you go. That's what Moshe Feinstein writes. You should know that this tshuva of Moshe Feinstein is used to this day in terms of being matragunas, okay? You know, when someone gets married to, if you call, you know, they have these organizations to try to help agunos. Kayama was the first one in Brooklyn. You know, you call Kayama, they'll tell you stories. I've worked with them in a number of cases. So a woman comes to you that she can't get a get. The first thing they want to know is, was the rabbi conservative? Was the Edim conservative? And, you know, once they can tell you that the Edim weren't Orthodox, therefore they're willing to, you know, to basically to annul the wedding, okay? Interesting. That's what Moshe Feinstein says right here. No question about it. What does Rav Henkin say about this? Rav Henkin says the following. Two pages from the end. Actually, let's go to the last page. Let's go to the last page, she says. Page 6. Second column. You see there's a paragraph kind of in a different font.
Yeah.
The Hapele Upele Mama, she says, and the amazing thing is, and it's really amazing, Tisamer Sarot Harosh, he says, my hair stands on end about this. Mashehikil Biniskadsha Lifneha Reformin. The fact that Ramosha Feinstein is Makil, is lenient, if someone gets married before a Reform rabbi. Vechi Yesh Tzorech. Do you need an officiating rabbi? Who cares that the rabbi at the wedding was a Reform Jew? Im Amar Yehudi Leisha, Hare At Sheli Bifnei Eden. If a man says to a woman in front of two other Jews that you are my wife, she is his wife. The fact that there's no rabbi making a speech doesn't affect the wedding, right? And what about in the case where Moshe Feinstein talks about where there were no witnesses, right? He's convinced that there were only Reformed Jews in the Reformed Temple, right? They lived together for 22 years. You're telling me that in those 22 years, there weren't two Orthodox people who saw them go into their house together, who didn't see them act as husband and wife, who couldn't give testimony that they were married? You know, they had children, they had a whole family, they were married. V'chezkas edus brura. Umihu yodeya mahu reform. For me who reform. V'shohayu edim ksheirim. He says, and in addition to that, don't be such a big shot. Who knows who's reformed and who's not reformed? Who knows who's a good witness or not? Maybe he's a reformed Jew, but maybe he's kosher as a witness. Who are we to say, umi hu yodeya mahu reform? It's an interesting line, isn't it? That's written by Rav Henkin. Not written by a modern Orthodox rabbi, written by Rav Henkin. He says, to allow a woman to get divorced or to leave such a marriage without a get, he says that's irresponsible. Now, one second, I need to pull this together, then I'll take your question. This is an interesting tshuva of Rav Henkin. You know why it's interesting? Because in this situation, Rav Moshe Feinstein's rejection of the Reform movement is actually to the benefit of the Orthodox. Mm-hmm. Rav Henkin's liberalism is actually to our detriment, right? You see how that works? Because according to Rav Moshe may be tough, being when you have a cross-denominational seminar, you probably don't want to learn Rav Moshe's tshuva. But for the purpose of the Orthodox, it's very helpful because it allows for agunos to remarry based on the fact that the reform is not a good marriage. Rav Henkin, who clearly takes a much more liberal view, umi yodeya mihu reform, but it harms us. Why? It harms us because, you know, women have more of a trouble, receiving that get and therefore be able to remarry. That is a very important point. Not here, but elsewhere, Rav Henkin addresses that point. He says two things about it. Number one, Rav Henkin says that, you know, I'm only telling you what I know. He says, and what I know about the Reform movement, and what I know about people being married, I know that people get married in different ways. You should know something. Rav Henkin had a disagreement with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Someone who has a civil marriage, right? Goes down to one center street and gets married in one center street. Do they need a get? Minig America is they do not need a get. We follow Rav Moshe Feinstein. They do not need a get. Rav Henkin said, of course they need a get.
Of course, yeah.
That's ridiculous. You tell me they get married one center street. They live together. They're husband and wife. You tell me there are no Eidim?
Is there a necessity for a rabbi at a wedding?
No, there's no necessity for a rabbi at a wedding.
So common law marriage is a kosher wedding.
No, we need two witnesses. But what Rav Henkin says is, you don't need two witnesses at the wedding. You need two witnesses to say they're husband and wife. And everybody has that. In New York City, there's, you know, every building has two kosher witnesses. You see them. They live together as husband and wife. It's kosher. You know, they're married. So Rav Henkin was machmir there too. Rav Henkin writes that this is just his awareness of the situation in America or the situation in New York City. One last point. Rav Henkin writes, though, at the end of his life, Rav Henkin writes that he wants to convene a group of rabbis to deal with the Aguna problem. Meaning that the fact that he says that Reform marriages are marriages, and the fact that he says that civil marriages are marriages, doesn't mean that he thinks that the Aguna problem is not a problem. He wanted to address the Aguna problem, and he wanted to somehow deal with the Aguna problem, okay? He was unable to do it, but it wasn't as if he was insensitive to the Aguna problem. I'm going to take all your questions in 1 second. What you see about Rav Henkin, you know, I think what you see about Rav Henkin is that he was honest in his position. His position was an appreciation and understanding, exactly like you said, you know, I'm answering your question. This was based on his appreciation of American society. Whether it was the Mechitza issue, what had to do with, you know, how you bring in the Reform movement, whether it had to do with the Manhattan Eruv, or whether it had to do with Reform or civil marriages, he dealt with how he saw it and addressing that question. I know he was honest. You know how I know he was honest? Well, he was Rav Henkin. But I know he was honest because he was willing to remain consistent in his view, even when his view was what? Well, not only unpopular, but counterproductive.
He could have,
that's a fair word. It was more machmir, it was stricter. Right? That's always a good sign. He remained consistent even when it was strict, even made it more difficult. Question, simply the question.
Our salvation is because it's so close to the era. When he was Masada Kedusha,
he wouldn't accept Edim. Right.
Here.
Correct. Okay. You know, what you need to look at, and I don't know the answer, you need to speak to Talmidim, was that what you called Hashkafa, or was that Halacha? I don't know the answer to that question. You have any question?
No, I was just going to say to Bob that by definition, the common law marriage under the common law was exactly what Bob asked you. In other words, the two people announced themselves husband and wife. There was no clergy, there was no other ceremony other than they stood up and said, we are husband and wife, and conducted themselves as husband and wife. And this, by the way, was quite usual during colonial times, when there was no clergy around, when there was no government, there was no civil marriage. People would make a public announcement in town, we are husband and wife, conduct themselves as husband and wife, and they got all of the miles and kasronis of being married. They were considered married.
Good. That's very good. Yeah.
Two comments. One, New York does not recognize common law marriage unless it's consummated in another state which does recognize it.
1942.
But the other comment I want to make about Robert Feinstein's decision is I thought I had heard that he decided in the context of the children, one of the children of this woman who got married in London, now wants to marry, is now become observant and now wants to marry an observant guy, and whether he can marry her was the factual scenario in which this responsa was written, dealing with whether the child is a momser or not.
He doesn't say that.
Well, have you heard that?
What difference does that make?
I'm just talking about the context. It's not as whether the wife needs to...
Yeah, no, the question is about the children from the second marriage. That's correct. That is absolutely right, yeah.
Well, I just want to say one thing. When you're talking about common law, we had a neighbor as recently as the 1990s whose parents had a common law marriage. They were from Russia. One was an agnostic and one was an anarchist, so they wouldn't get married by a rabbi, and they wouldn't get married by the law. They lived in New York, and it was accepted. When the husband died, the wife applied for Social Security. It was accepted as a marriage. So I don't know what the laws are, but I know that that happened because the daughter told me. But what I wanted to ask you was, do you think, and I don't know at all, that this was a way of partially solving the Aguna problem here in America, because you could discount a large portion of the marriages that were taking place easily by coming to this tshuva, and Hankin was living on the Lower East Side where you had more Orthodox Jews and their problems with
could be. It means he was more local, therefore he didn't deal with the bigger question, right? I don't know that the Rav Hankin supporters would like it to be said that way, but I think that probably is true. Yeah.
I had heard, so I'm giving you hearsay now, and I can't tell you, you know, for certainty, but what Simcha said before about Rav Hankin, that his tshuvas were really personal to the people who came to him. That in that vein, and consistent with that, he did void certain marriages based upon a holding that there was no intention for there to be a marriage. And that was the classic and unfortunate story of some kid who learned the basics of halacha, of how you get married. You say harayai, and kidding around at a party, he would hand his class ring to a girl and say the whole ritual statement, and then somebody would say, well, you guys are married. And that these cases were brought to Rav Hankin, and after extensive drisha b'chakira, after investigation, he would say, in those cases where he could, he would say there was no intent for kiddushin. It wasn't something that was done with the intent to have a marriage, and he would find a way that this was not kiddushin. And
okay.
Again, the old problem of marrying a kohen, you know, when she finally did get married properly, there was a problem when she was going to marry a kohen. So that's why the intent was to try and find a way to avoid the marriage, not to hold up that she needed to get.
Okay, absolutely right. I think
I heard this. I've heard
okay.
this.
Okay, very good. And yeah.
had a case with two students of Hamas.
But I mean, they everybody has those stories, but they those things just kind of go away, don't they?
No, it was taken very seriously.
It was.
Yes.
Oh, that is interesting. Okay. With that, we close the semester. Obviously, it's just kind of an example of of the phenomenon of American rabbis dealing with American kind of questions. But I think we get a flavor of some of the issues, some of the kind of approaches, and hopefully a flavor for what the history of American Judaism is all about. Thanks a lot for coming, for enjoying, and for learning together with me. The next semester is not sure. We'll let you know. As soon as it's worked out, you'll be informed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.